about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Said Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the US and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stress that they would not back down.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Said Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony.
What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This was the first visit by Afghan interim foreign minister to Pakistan. The fact Pakistan provided its plane to Amir Khan Muttaqi highlights the precarious economic situation the Afghan government is facing at the moment. Muttaqi met Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan, who assured all-out support to the people of Afghanistan in the wake of worsening humanitarian and economic crisis.
There are a number of issues which Pakistan and the Afghan government, especially the Taliban regime, they will be talking about, particularly engaging with the world. And you know, Taliban are ready to get engaged with the world.
The visit of the Afghan interim foreign minister was coincided with a meeting of top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China and the United States. Known as Trika Plus, the special envoys of these four countries discussed the current Afghan situation. They also met the Afghan interim foreign minister.
This was the first time that top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China and the United States together held talks with the Afghan interim foreign minister. Amir Khan Muttaqi was informed about the expectations of the international community from the Taliban government.
A joint statement issued by the Trika Plus reminded the Taliban of its promises they made with the international community. The Afghan foreign minister was told that the Taliban need to form more inclusive and representative government. At the same time, the Taliban government was reminded of its commitment to cut ties with all terrorist groups. But Pakistan, Russia, China and the US favor engagement with the Taliban government.
We believe Taliban are interested in engagement as they seek international acceptance and support. It is therefore crucial that the international community avoids repeating mistakes of the past and continues with positive engagement.
The four countries expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and promised to extend all possible help, while the US has refused to unfreeze $9.5 billion Afghan central bank assets. But there is no indication if any of the country is willing to recognize the Taliban government yet. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
Authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full. After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terrans fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, more than 6.5 years have passed since Saudi Arabia initiated its onslaught on the Yemeni people, a violent bombing campaign of the infrastructure as well as civilian areas caused an extensive amount of damage, and more importantly, it caused the loss of so many lives. However, the tide has changed as the Yemeni army currently has the upper hand and is now on the verge of taking over the oil-rich city of Ma'arib. Is defeat near for the Saudis and all of their allies from the Persian Gulf to the West? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight. I'm going to start this discussion off crossing over to Sana'a, talking to Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Thank you so much. Actually, the Yemeni army managed to liberate the Al-Falaj area. The Saudi coalitions have a military checkpoint in that area, and so many travelers have been or have got kidnapped in that military point. It is the eastern gate to Marib. The Yemeni army managed to liberate this area, and this is an important point for the Yemeni army and important advantage for the Yemeni army to keep encircling the city and liberate the city from the Taliban forces and also from the terrorist groups. Actually, the leader of the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khalid al-Bathouthi, admitted that they have been fighting alongside the Taliban coalition forces in 11 military fronts, including Marib. He said that their participation is insistent, and no one can deny that. And this admission refutes the allegations of the Saudi-backed forces and the Saudi-backed coalition that they are not using terrorists to fight Yemeni army. Yemen's armed forces have been saying that for 7 years, that they are not fighting only the invaders, but also the terrorist groups, which is in Marib or in Al-Bayda or Taiz or Hudaybah or the front across the country. In Al-Fadayda, the Emirati-backed forces have suddenly withdrawn their forces from so many areas, and I believe that they will continue their withdrawal to lift the city for the enemy army to control the city. Military experts say that this withdrawal comes in the process of gathering the forces to protect the Abad al-Mandab of the state, and also to protect the south of Yemen, as the Yemeni army is liberating Marib just a matter of time, and they want to lift Marib and think about what will be after the falling of Marib in the hands of the Yemeni army.
All right, thanks so much. That was our update out of Sana'a from our correspondent on the ground there, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Now I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Hausa with Brett. As time goes on, why does it appear to be more difficult for the Saudis to inflict defeat on the Yemeni army?
I think the main reason for this is that the Saudis have gone to war with much the same strategy as their overlord, so to say, the Americans, and the Israelis have always been doing. That is the shock and awe strategy, the idea that by overwhelming them with military hardware, with military prowess and power, by a massive display of what you can field in battle, that will overwhelm the enemy in to such an extent that they will completely collapse, that their morale will collapse, and you can basically take over the country in a matter of weeks. That's the idea, the strategy, the doctrine that is behind a lot of the invasions that the United States has waged in the past 20 years. It is the strategy behind what the Israelis are doing in Palestine for decades now. And it's the same doctrine that the Saudis have been trying to use. Unfortunately for them, the shock and awe doctrine is completely and utterly useless against a nation that is united in a common cause, because you cannot defeat a country with military hardware alone, especially if that military hardware, like the Saudis and the Americans and the Zionists, when that military hardware is specifically aimed at air superiority. And that is what we have seen for so long already. One of the first things that the Saudis did is, when they attacked Yemen, is almost completely destroy the Yemeni Air Force. And that's why, up until this point, the Yemeni Air Force is nearly non-existent indeed. They still, the Yemeni Air Force as a unit still exists, but a majority field drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles. They don't have any airplanes. So Saudi Arabia still maintains air superiority, just like the Americans have done when they invaded Afghanistan, when they invaded Iraq, and still like what the Zionists have over Palestine right now. But the problem is, you cannot defeat a country like that. You cannot win a war just by bombing alone. You can win battles, you can advance rapidly, but you cannot maintain. And that is exactly what has been happening here. The Saudis have been overwhelming the Yemenis in the beginning of this war, have been advancing many, many hundreds of kilometers into Yemeni land, but they have not been able to really capture large territory of, like, large population centers, especially in the north and in the west, where the population of Yemen is majority local.
So was it, let me just jump in here, was it a total miscalculation? Let me throw this, let me cross over to London and say it, Mohsen. How do you see it? Was there a total miscalculation going into this to begin with by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, by their those who support them, like the Americans and the Brits?
I think there was a huge miscalculation. I mean, they called it the Operation Decisive Storm, precisely because they thought that it would be all done and dusted within 3 or 4 weeks. That's exactly what bin Salman, who initiated this this war, thought, what he intended. Of course, that comes as a complete shock to them that it it hasn't worked out that way. The American intelligence has obviously failed on this. The Zionist intelligence has failed on this in terms of giving the Saudis insufficient reports on what the Yemeni morale was, what the Ansarullah's morale was, what their capabilities were. Those capabilities, of course, have grown rapidly during the war since 2015. But at that time, clearly they got some very, very bad intelligence. And what actually has transpired is that the Saudis have now spent in excess of $300 billion on a war against almost the poorest, if not the poorest, nation on the Arab Peninsula. And in return, they've really failed in every target that they had. In fact, the reverse has happened. The Yemeni Ansarullah forces have not only held them up till 2018, but actually in 2018 turned the tables on them and actually went for the jugular, went on the offensive. And that offensive is absolutely mind-boggling, because the equipment of the Yemenis, the tactics of the Yemenis, the strategies of fighting, etc., have been absolutely amazing and a real kind of eye-opener for any military.
What do you think has been key in that, Zayed Mohsen? I mean, you talked about the offensive and how they have turned the tables. I mean, what has been key in that, being able to turn the tables, even though you just pointed out rightfully it's totally inequitable if we compare the type of equipment that both sides have?
Well, number one, the Yemenis have a huge faith. This is really not to be underestimated. Their spiritual and religious commitment to anti-oppression, towards the anti against tyranny, against the Saudis' tyranny, of course, but also the Zionist tyranny, was totally, I think, underestimated by their enemies. The tactics that they've employed have been unique insofar as they haven't gone out and fought like a standard army, if you like. They've not really battled in those formations that you'd expect. And what they've done is they've employed methods of hit and run, methods in which small groups of small units have gone in, done the operations, and then disappeared into the sand almost. I mean, that's perplexed and totally bamboozled a Saudi military which was armed to the the teeth with missiles and all the latest hardware. How do you fight an army which can disappear, not only into the desert, underground, overground, wherever, or even into the towns and villages? You're basically fighting the people. So where are you going to find these forces to fight? Not only that, they've actually demoralized a mercenary army, because the Saudis didn't want a boots on the ground situation. Because the air power failed, what they did was started to import mercenaries from Sudan, Somalia, other places. So these mercenaries that they're fighting are not dedicated to any cause or commitment, whereas the Ansarullah are fighting for their families, for their children, for their nation. There are many differences to this virtual victory, I see.
Okay, well, Brett, tell us the importance of what is happening right now, because we know about the situation in Ma'arif and the offensive and every day having more and more victories. The importance of capturing Ma'arif.
We have to bear in mind that Ma'arif is the last and only major stronghold that the Saudis and their supporters still have in central and central northern Yemen. Except for Ma'arif, their entire stronghold, their entire foothold in Yemen is almost entirely concentrated in the thinly populated, be it strategically located, south and east of Yemen, which is very sparsely populated, which is not a very well developed area when compared to the more populated areas that are still under control of the National Salvation Government and protected by Ansar Allah and their allies. So when Ma'arif falls, this will be a very massive blow, not just militarily, but also economically and spiritually, mentally, for the Saudis and their allies. We already know, of course, that the Saudis, when it comes to Yemen itself, to Yemeni troops, the few Yemenis that are fighting on their side are for the majority members of the Islam Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan movement in branch in Yemen. And we know that within the Islam Party there is a growing rift that has started, especially in Ma'arif, in which some groups of the Islam Party are thinking of negotiating and have already even offered certain venues of negotiations that so far unfortunately have not yet led to a capitulation of the city. But it is definitely a start. And one of the reasons for that being is that the National Salvation Government still to this very day offers a general amnesty to every mercenary, every Yemeni who joined the Saudi forces, who decides to defect, put down the weapons or hand in their weapons and decides to return back to civilian life. It is perfectly still, that venue is still open. So aside from that loss of a major Islam Party stronghold, the potential loss of the last vestige of northern and central Yemeni power that the Saudis still have, there is the massive economic importance in terms of oil and gas. Not so much necessarily that the Saudis need the oil, but the oil is now at least kept out of Yemeni hands. That is their goal. Try to keep the country as poor as you can be. If that oil were to go back into Yemeni hands, and Yemen could possibly, potentially in the near future, negotiate further economical oil deals with other countries, if the government in Sana'a could somehow manage to sell that oil on the international market again, this is a massive influx of funds again that belongs to Yemen, but so far has been kept out of Yemen for almost 7 years now. So when all these things come together, and we have to bear in mind that at this point it's not only in Ma'arif, but also the east coast has been, the areas have been liberated at a rapid pace. Just today, there was a report that the Kilo 16 area, which is the major road between Sana'a and Hodeidah, mm-hmm. has been liberated and has reopened after 3 years of Emirati blockade. The Emiratis have retreated. The Yemenis have moved back in, and the road, the direct routes between the major cities of Sana'a and the major port city of Hodeidah, both of them who are in hands of the National Salvation Government, that road is open again now. There is a direct line of transportation from the port to Sana'a. All these things taken together represent a complete and total breakdown of Saudi and Emirati stranglehold in central Yemen, which means that they will have to withdraw almost completely to the south, to Aden and to Hadramaut.
Okay. Well, said Mohsen, let's look at the Saudi allies, such as the United States and Britain. Both countries had discussed the need to curtail sales of further military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but we've seen the opposite. The Biden administration has recently approved $500 million more. I mean, why do both these Western countries continue to show their hypocritical policies when it comes to Yemen? On the one hand, it says that the violence must cease and civilians should not be killed. On the other hand, we see that they continue to support the Saudi regime.
Well, the entire strategy and policy of, if you like, Zionist exceptionalism across the world, and of course the domination of that region and the plunder of the resources of that region, has relied fundamentally on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been the one that has been buying a lot of the nations around that region with its dollars, persuading them, maintaining a status quo, making sure that they didn't rebel against the Zion-American order in that region. So Saudi Arabia has been a linchpin, really, for Anglo-Zionist policy and imperialism in that region, keeping all of the nations to heel. Of course, the reality is that the situation is changing. The resistance axis has fundamentally changed the dynamics in this region. For the relevance of Yemen, of course, whilst it was under the Saudi yoke, Yemen was not allowed to access its nickel, gold, copper, cobalt. You know, the oil and gas fields have been mentioned, but there's been a huge amount of wealth which has been suppressed by the Saudis. They've not allowed the Yemeni rulers, who were their puppets, to unearth any of those. You've also got this entire situation, for instance, with the outcome of the current situation changing the face of West Asia, potentially. What happens in Marib is no small thing. It could literally change the face of West Asian geopolitics and geoeconomics. Firstly, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait leads straight to the Suez, so that immediately hits Israel and Egypt. If the Ansarullah were to take control of that entire strait, it would cause huge problems for the likes of Israel and Egypt in their strategies and policies. It would be a win-win for the likes of China and the Islamic Republic of Iran, who would essentially have a major ally on the Arabian Peninsula, a diehard ally in a way. This has been hard won. The 13 out of 14 districts that have been now defeated or brought under control by the Ansarullah have come at a cost of many, many lives. But they are now at the point where only the city itself is running free, and they have maybe one base, a Saudi base in the region, which is there, which will very likely easily be overcome.
Okay.
80% now, if this happens, 80% of the Yemeni population will be governed by Ansarullah. That is huge. And they, as my colleagues stated earlier, they control the water and the oil of the nation, which actually will boost, give a morale boost to the entire resistance movement there, if you like. So it's no mean feat. If this actually goes through, even the likes of the United Arab Emirates, who control the ports down in the south currently, and who nurture Al-Qaeda, ISIS types in their midst, all will be under a huge, if you like, a decision-making process they'll have to go to, because already Dubai and Abu Dhabi have been threatened by drones and missiles by the Ansarullah, but they haven't gone for their jugular. The Saudis have tasted that threat very, very consistently, but it remains to be seen that if UAE is turned on, how long they would even stay around in the south once it falls.
All right. Well, Brett, a former Trump official, David Schechner, has said that the U.S. must prepare itself for the Saudis losing in Yemen. What does this mean exactly? I mean, on the one hand, is it that Washington actually realizes that the Yemeni army and people will be victorious soon? And on the other hand, if it does realize that, why then does it continue to support what Riyadh is doing?
I think we must not underestimate, of course, the power of what is called the war hawks in the United States, both in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the State Department, and in the House of Representatives in the United States. There is a massive support base of both the typical neoconservative war hawks, as well as the war hawks on the liberal side, and of course something that must never be forgotten, the Zionist lobby, which has a massive influence, unfortunately, still to this day, in United States policies. And you see with people like starting in with Obama and continuing under Trump, and now as well continuing under Joe Biden, that on both sides of the aisle, be they Democrat or Republican, you have those people who are diehard, dyed-in-the-wool supporters of the Zionist project, who are backed by the Zionist lobby, who are bought and in the pocket of the lobbies of the military arms industry. And Joe Biden is most definitely a very good example of a quote-unquote progressive liberal war hawk, because he has been in the pocket of these lobbies since decades already, so this should not be surprising. Of course, what we do see now is that there are more and more. Recently, there were 30 senators just a few days ago who in the U.S. Senate have proposed a total ban on supporting Saudi Arabia. These are people who have seen that there is no point in supporting this war any longer because their defeat is already certain. And these are people who most likely are not considered, have not been bribed yet, or are not considered important enough by the lobby to necessarily buy them. The interesting thing is that both Trump and Joe Biden, when they were running for president, they both of them agreed and promised to their electorate and were elected partially by people who wanted to stop supporting Saudi Arabia. They both promised that, both from a Republican and a Democratic point of view, that they would stop supporting Saudi Arabia. Of course, the moment they get elected, they have completely withdrawn that promise and done the absolute opposite. Because again, you know, these lobbies that are at work behind the scenes. But when you see now that how the situation is going now, I think the United States will have, and that is what this former advisor of Trump's, I think, is getting at, the United States will have to come to terms with the fact that there is no future for this war to go their way. It is as good as impossible that the Saudis will win this in a normal military way. And in order, of course, to pull as much as they can out of the fire, let's say, from the U.S. perspective, they will have to pressure Saudi Arabia to negotiate. They will have to pretend that it was not the United States is doing, but it was more like, you know, a mistake made in Riyadh and by Riyadh alone, because they don't want to happen what my colleague here said. They don't. Americans, of course, don't want Yemen to really completely go on the bandwagon of the axis of resistance. They don't want Yemen to be an ally of Iran, an ally of China, of Russia, and of the axis of resistance of Palestine, of course. In general, so they will probably try to somehow get in Yemen's good graces again in order to try to deviate the goals of the revolution.
Let me just get said, Mohsen, in 30 seconds. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brett. Just 30 seconds, said Mohsen. You heard what Brett said, that this would probably what they would try to do. Do you think that they would be successful in actually then trying to negotiate with the Yemenis and trying to prevent, as Brett had said, basically this major support or expansion of support of the resistance? How do your assessment of what's going to happen? 30 seconds. I know it's not a lot of time, but I know you can do it.
Well, very simply, no. The Americans have lost faith and trust. And not only that, let's not forget the Ansarullah have an ideological base. That ideological base is anti-tyranny, anti-imperialism. They will not drop their guard. I think if they would come to power, they will be a fair, just government, but they will not kowtow to the Israelis or to the Americans, nor will they cut deals with them.
I'd like to thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. The historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
the beginning of the year, Democrats knew they had a rare opportunity to make transformational change. With control of the White House and Congress, they stuffed ambitious programs meant to address decades of inaction on childcare, paid leave, poverty, housing, and climate, and to cover holes in our healthcare system into a single package. The article you're about to hear has been published by the New York Times opinion section. The article has been written by Bryce Covert, a journalist who focuses on the economy. The piece is titled, Joe Manchin, This Is What We Can't Afford. At the beginning of the year, Democrats knew they had a rare opportunity to make transformational change. With control of the White House and Congress, they stuffed ambitious programs meant to address decades of inaction on childcare, unpaid leave, poverty, housing, and climate, and to cover holes in our healthcare system into a single package. Those dreams have run aground on a few holdout Democratic lawmakers. Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have insisted on skimpy spending numbers, even if the spending is offset by higher revenues. Senator Manchin is forcing excruciating decisions between Democratic priorities, but he insists that it's in the name of fiscal responsibility, of not incurring too great a cost for the government. When President Biden released a sharply pared-down framework meant to appease the centrists, Senator Manchin refused to sign off because he's worried about the impact it will have on our national debt, our economy, and the American people. Now, Senator Manchin is signaling that he wants to slow walk his party's legislative package because of increasing inflation, even though the spending will be doled out over a decade and will have no impact on price increases today, while it will eventually help ease household budget crunches. What Senator Manchin fails to understand is that we have been enduring enormous costs from our failure to do these things and will continue to incur them if we don't do enough to meet this moment. The pain is borne by individual Americans who struggle to flourish and stay healthy. But every single one of us suffers from an enfeebled economy and a poorly functioning society. Inaction comes with its own price. We pay it in the form of foregone human potential. We pay it in the form of lower productivity and a smaller workforce, and an economy failing to function at its full capacity. And we also pay for it in human lives. These are very real consequences. To ignore this side of the ledger and focus solely on how much is being spent is, at the very least, ignorant, and at worst, cruel. The United States has an exceptionally high childhood poverty rate. By failing to offer parents more support in the early years, we pay a huge penalty. Robust economic research has found that giving children more resources when they're young results in fewer infant deaths, improved health, longer lives, less interaction with the criminal justice system, and higher earnings. Those outcomes are vitally important in each individual child's life, but they're also important to everyone. The whole economy reaps the benefit of less spending on medical care and higher tax payments from healthier, more productive individuals. The opposite, of course, is also true. If we fail to give children the resources they need to thrive, then we incur the cost through poorer health and reduced potential. Children bear the burden of lower income and shortened lives. Even tinkering with the current expansion of the child tax credit, which right now is sending nearly all parents' monthly payment of $300 for children under the age of 6 and $250 for older children through the end of the year quickly exposes more kids to these harms. Imposing a $60,000 income threshold on those payments going forward, as Senator Manchin at one point proposed, would take it away from 37.4 million American children. President Biden has proposed keeping it as is, but extending it for only 1 year, threatening a chance to significantly reduce poverty and hardship for good. Another way to invest in children, and at the same time to invest in their parents, is to ensure that families can secure and afford high-quality childcare and early education. Reams of research have shown that there are huge rewards to be gained for children's development from robust universal early education, gains that follow them throughout their lives. Childcare also frees parents, and in particular mothers, to work outside of the home. Universal preschool in the District of Columbia, introduced in 2009, increased the labor force participation rate for mothers with young children by 10 percentage points. Universal childcare in Quebec in Canada, begun in 1996, helped the province achieve the highest rate of prime-age working women in the world. The resulting increase in tax revenue has more than covered the cost of Quebec's program. But by and large, the United States is paying the price of a failure to invest significant federal money in childcare and in early education, and we will continue down that road if childcare funding is cut back or stripped from the Democrats' package. Labor force participation for American mothers is 19% lower than for similar childless women. As recently as 1990, we led the world in how many women were in our workforce, but we've since slipped back to the bottom of the rankings, and a lack of investment in childcare is one of the main culprits. Another culprit is a lack of guaranteed paid family leave. President Biden originally planned to ensure all workers 12 weeks of pay for a new child, serious illness, military deployment, death in the family, or in the case of domestic violence and sexual assault, which would have allowed 18 million people, more than a tenth of the entire civilian labor force, to take paid leave each year. Ditching this provision from the package, which President Biden did to appease Senator Manchin, means those millions of people will be faced with either losing income to care for themselves or their families, or neglecting that care and continuing to work. Guaranteeing only 4 weeks, as House leadership has proposed, won't get postpartum parents or seriously sick spouses terribly far. The United States now guarantees 12 weeks of unpaid family leave, and that's just for the 56% who qualify. Without guaranteed pay, 7% of all employees in 2018 needed to take leave but didn't, and the majority said it was because they couldn't afford to. Many of those who did manage to take unpaid leave experienced financial difficulties. More than three-quarters of people who got partial pay or nothing at all cut back on their spending, and about 30% borrowed money or put off paying bills. Nearly one in five had to go on public assistance. Paid leave, on the other hand, would not only give people the money they need to survive and stay out of debt, it would also keep them attached to their jobs by allowing them the chance to step away without a financial penalty when life demands it. That's true not just for new parents who need time to bond with and care for new babies, but also for those whose loved ones suffer a health emergency or a new disability. An estimated 6 million extra people would stay connected to the labor force if we had paid leave. Without it, we'll keep hemorrhaging workers. Some of the people we're losing are forced to serve away to care for disabled or elderly family members. More than 800,000 people are on waiting lists to receive professional home-based care through Medicaid. And that's just for those who have spent down their assets or never had enough to begin with to qualify for the program. Democrats had at first proposed spending $400 billion on home-based care for the disabled and the elderly, which would have been enough to clear Medicaid's waiting list. But President Biden and his legislative allies have now reduced that figure by nearly two-thirds. Without enough federal funding to ensure that Americans can get the professional care at home that they deserve, the responsibility often falls to family members. More than 40 million Americans already provide unpaid care to older relatives, which makes it difficult to work for pay. Children who care for elderly parents stand to lose more than $300,000 over their lifetimes in wages and retirement benefits. And once again, it's not just an individual burden. The whole economy loses billions of dollars in productivity when people are forced to miss work to take care of their family members. The aged also deserve to have insurance to care for their entire bodies, including their ears, eyes, and teeth. Most rely on Medicare for their health insurance, but it doesn't cover dental, vision, or hearing treatment. If it were expanded to cover those body parts, an estimated 62 million older Americans would benefit. But President Biden's framework includes only hearing benefits. Without a full expansion, older Americans who can't afford private coverage will suffer with rotting teeth and deteriorating eyesight. An additional 2.2 million people may be left high and dry if Democrats fail to help those who live in the 12 states that have refused to expand Medicaid. People who qualify neither for the program nor for the subsidies that make Affordable Care Act exchange coverage affordable will continue to face catastrophic financial burden in one study's terms when they need unexpected surgery but don't have insurance. They'll face higher maternal mortality, more opioid deaths, and a greater risk of suicide. As we keep incurring thousands of needless deaths a year, Americans will pay for congressional inaction with their lives. Democrats originally included enough money for housing to cut homelessness in half within 5 years, but that funding is now half of what it was. Without enough resources, the approximately 580,000 Americans who have no homes of their own will continue to live with poorer health and lower employment. We'll all be saddled with the extra cost of trying to keep them healthy and offering them public assistance instead of a stable place to live. Giving them housing, on the other hand, quickly recoups most of the costs through the benefits of improved health and improved employment. Half a glass of water is always better than an empty one, but Democrats are at risk of wasting an opportunity to show the country what they can do with a full one by putting their slim majorities to work doing as much as they can to help real people and save real lives. They have the chance to create a healthier, happier, more productive country. The details of the legislative package are certain to change as negotiations continue. There will be immense pressure for lawmakers to lower their ambitions in the name of fiscal responsibility. But there's nothing responsible about allowing more children's potential to be stunted, to keep women from their full economic potential, to let people's health be harmed and lives cut short. The price of failing to deliver is more than we can afford. We'll be right back.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up,